Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, June 18th, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Election Protection. Illinois counties are getting $13.2 million to safeguard your voting information. Ryan Voiles writes from Decatur, Illinois counties could get a cut of $13.2 million to fortify election databases and avoid a repeat of the 2016 election, when as many as 76,000 voters' data may have been compromised. National security officials say voting systems in 21 states were targeted by Russian-connected hackers 2 years ago, prompting Congress to allocate $380 million to secure election systems and shore up cybersecurity. Use of Illinois' money is laid out in the state budget approved this spring, which designates no less than half be used to create a cyber navigator program to support the efforts of election authorities to defend against cyber breaches and detect and recover from attacks. We became sort of the poster child for what can happen and how you deal with it, said Matt Dietrich, an Illinois State Board of Elections spokesman. In Illinois, the Board of Elections noted a breach of its electronic voter database in July 2016 and worked to stop the intrusion, yet later notified voters that their data may have been viewed by hackers. The agency executive director, Steve Sandvoss, said in February that the threat to cybersecurity during the state's upcoming November election was very real. A conference next week in Bloomington featuring election officials and law enforcement seeks to tackle the issue. Helping to organize the event is six-term Logan County Clerk Sally Turner, who said officials like county clerks are now in a spot where knowledge on cybersecurity is just as important as how to run an election. Most county clerks have no idea that when they ran for office, that they would have to be an IT director, she said. And so this is helping us get a basic knowledge of what is all this information that is out there and how do we decipher it all. Macon County Clerk Steve Bean said online security for his office has become a top priority in the rapidly changing world of technology and outside threats. I've probably had more meetings in the last 2 years over cybersecurity than any other thing related to elections, said Bean, who has served as the county's chief election official since 1990. No one knows yet how much money each county could receive to improve security or guidelines for how that money could be spent. Dietrich said the Board of Elections is working alongside agencies such as the Illinois Department of Innovation and Technology, Illinois State Police, and the Illinois Statewide Terrorism and Intelligence Center to set up the program. Local entities who are part of the program will be eligible to apply for some of the federal dollars. The aim of the previously reported attacks have not been to make any changes to ballots or votes on election day, specifically because ballot machines are intentionally not online. Instead, Dietrich said the aim has been to affect seemingly trivial things like to remove a person's name from their polling place or change where a person is registered to vote. It could create inconvenience, tension, and lines at polling places, he said, and it's all part of what we've heard from the U.S. Justice Department. They say the goal was to create chaos in American institutions and thereby weaken those systems and basically discourage confidence in government. President Donald Trump's top intelligence advisor in February told a Senate committee that Russia is moving to build on its earlier efforts to interfere with U.S. elections, which included a sustained campaign of propaganda and the unleashing of cyber operatives. There should be no doubt that Russia perceives its past efforts as successful and views the 2018 U.S. midterm elections as a potential target, said Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence. No evidence indicates that hackers succeeded in directly tinkering with votes, but there is ongoing concern that voter registration technology is vulnerable to hacking. The Illinois cyber attacks were highlighted in 60 Minutes report in April, and Sandvoss told reporter Bill Whitaker it amounted to a fast-growing tumor that was unlike anything we had ever seen. The state was able to plug website holes after hackers got bits of information on thousands of voters and complete records of 3,500, according to the story. Illinois election officials said before the March primary, which came 2 years after that 2016 attack, that they had beefed up defenses and were scanning for possible intrusions. State Board of Elections officials also told Fox News this spring that about 76,000 Illinois voters may have had their information viewed. A total of 14,121 of them were residents of Galesburg, according to the report. The threats of election hacking go back farther than the most recent general election, said Glenn Sagers, professor of cybersecurity in the School of Information Technology at Illinois State University. In 2005, a test of machines made by popular election equipment company Diebold showed that they could be hacked without notice. Known as the Hursti hack, the controlled experiment showed that election equipment was susceptible just like any other piece of technology. As Sagers sees it, the issue comes down to a combination of information that is of interest to potential hackers and software that may not be as well guarded as necessary. A lot of times the software just isn't well written, Sagers said. So, if you're susceptible to that or any other kinds of attacks, you can get in there and change the records and there wouldn't be any records you were ever there as an attacker. More emphasis has been put on securing elections in the past year and a half. In the federal budget passed earlier this year, $380 million was allocated for the Help American Vote Act, set aside to provide funds to assist state and local election officials in improving cybersecurity related to elections. As of June 5th, 26 states have requested $209 million, according to the Election Assistance Commission. Improving one's security can be costly, Bean said. Aside from new equipment, the cost of hiring specialists to analyze and test one's systems start in the thousands of dollars and quickly go up from there. The new election equipment Macon County purchased in 2016 cost $550,000, which was covered by revenue brought in by permits purchased for the county's wind farm project. Bean said earlier this week that the equipment was purchased in part because the county's old equipment was shown to be susceptible to hacking. And then there is what Josh Tanner calls the cat-and-mouse nature of protecting oneself from hackers. Tanner, who oversees information technology in the Macon County office building, along with his role as supervisor of assessments, said recent security upgrades include new election equipment in the clerk's office and updated firewall, which acts as a filter to block unauthorized access while allowing legitimate outward communication to go through without issue. The county is also connected to state and federal security bulletins and will contact local officials if there is any detection of an attempt to breach their data. But as the county changes its tactics, so too do potential hackers. They will try to probe the system, and then when we notice high levels of traffic from overseas countries, then we can shut that entire country off from accessing the site and see if legitimate customers call and say, hey, we cannot access the county's website anymore, Tanner said. But by that point, they move on to another location. He could not go into specifics due to the sensitivity of the information, but Tanner said there has been several occasions where the county saw an unusual spike in traffic from specific countries, which required them to block certain regions from accessing the county website. Much of the pressure to protect the integrity of elections fall on those election officials, which can be jarring for those like Turner. When you run as a clerk, you certainly don't think this is a thing you'll have to deal with, she said. I mean, we have enough things to deal with, let alone cybersecurity. But hey, it's just another hat. Turner is helping to set up the conference next week in Bloomington, which will see county clerks, election commissioners, and officials with the Illinois State Police, Department of Homeland Security, and the Election Assistance Commission to better educate officials on election security, from recognizing and reporting a threat, to how hackers can try to access their networks. Turner, who has undergone cybersecurity training, said it can be a challenge to know all the ways that hackers can attempt to access their network. A common example is with an email with a generic headline like invoice and an attached PDF file. By opening that file, Turner said hackers can immediately access and corrupt the email recipient's network. Officials like Bean, Turner, and McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael said they already are hard at work to improve their cybersecurity and to prevent any attacks ahead of the November 6th election. For Michael, public awareness of the training will also go a far way to letting voters know that efforts are being made to ensure the integrity of future elections. I think the public needs to be made aware. The rights of voters here in Illinois are really being protected with great vigor, she said. Continuing on the front page, Tony Reed writes, and the heat goes on. Steamy weather ideal for convertibles, bad for everything else. From Decatur, Paul Workman pilots the perfect hot car for a broiling June afternoon, a banana yellow Corvette convertible. It looks pretty fast even when it's standing still, which it was doing Sunday afternoon, lined up for smoldering admiration and inspection at the Vinnie's Barbecue 17th Annual Car Show, hosted on the grounds of the Glass House on North Oakland Avenue. Workman was prepared, however, with his own portable sun awning set up next to the car and battery-powered fan cradled on his chest. I don't mind the heat, he said, as the mercury accelerated past 92 and the heat index topped out at 100. Better than rain. Car show organizer Vinnie Barbie wasn't so sure, however. I've got about 15 cars so far, he said around 4 p.m., as other entries were still arriving, and the show normally gets about 40 cars. But I think the heat is not helping me out. It's too hot. It's miserable. But I am happy the people still came out to support me and help the homeless. The show raises money for my block party for the homeless in the second week in August. The heat misery was so bad it prompted a heat advisory warning from the National Weather Service office in Lincoln that lasts through 7 p.m. tonight. Heat indexes spiking to more than 100 mean dangerous conditions that can bring on severe illness and worsen existing health problems for those who stay outside too long or overexert themselves. We definitely advise taking breaks in air conditioning, limiting time outdoors, and limiting the intensity of what you do outdoors, said Daryl Anton, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Also, be very aware of where children, pets, and the elderly are, and make sure they are taken care of as well. Today's high is expected to nudge 94, similar to Sunday's high, with a heat index reading around 103. Then will come a refreshing cooling trend through the weekdays with a low Thursday night of 67 after a daytime high near 82. Anton said the weekend is expected to be hot again, but probably not as hot as the weekend just passed. Highs around the mid-80s and yet feeling hotter due to the persistent humidity. But even the recent steam bath temperatures poaching central Illinois pale in comparison with the record Decatur temperature for June 17th, set back in the pre-air-conditioned days of post-World War I. Onton said the thermometer peaked at 102 in 1918. And from the local page, Illinois pharmacies pushing for more data. Independent pharmacies were unable to win protections in the recently adjourned legislative session against what they see as predatory business practices and misuse of state dollars in the state's Medicaid-managed care program, Health Choice Illinois. But they hope to pass legislation in the General Assembly's fall veto session that requires disclosure of information from the often secretive dealings between managed care organizations, subcontracting companies known as pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs, and pharmacies that depend on PBMs for payment. The new information, pharmacies and their supporters say, could unveil what they suspect are profit padding and unnecessarily steep reductions in what pharmacies receive for serving Medicaid patients compared with what pharmacies receive under fee-for-service rates. Pharmacy owners say cuts in payments for the medicines they dispense and per-prescription dispensing fees aren't saving the state money on health care for low-income Illinoisans. But the reductions threaten to push many pharmacies out of business with no backup plan for patients, especially in rural and downstate areas, pharmacy owners say. The impact of those cuts mandated by PBMs has grown with the reboot of the managed care program this year and its expansion to all 102 counties on April 1st. We had a tough lift with getting the bill as far as we did, Garth Reynolds, executive director of the Illinois Pharmacists Association, said of House Bill 3479. Which passed the Illinois House but never received a vote by the full Senate. We will continue to work on this over the summer, he said last week. It's the political process. This is going to be a long fight. Senator Andy Menar said the Illinois Pharmacists Association presented compelling evidence that managed care is hurting independent pharmacies. But Menar, the bill's Senate sponsor, said there's a lack of statewide data to justify majority support in the General Assembly for what could be seen as more intrusion by government into the private sector. The original version of House Bill 3479 also had technical problems, he said. David Falk, a Moroa resident who owns 12 downstate Save More pharmacies, including those in Verdon, Nokomis, and Mount Pulaski, said the Pharmacists Association didn't necessarily lose when a bill failed to pass both chambers of the legislature this spring. I don't think we're done by any means, he said. Long term, something's going to have to be done. The information disclosure requirements in the amended bill would be a positive step, Fox said. We want to see what the middleman is keeping, he said. Falk, 48, said he doesn't know whether he would qualify for the critical access payments. Budget documents say the payments could go only to owners of fewer than 10 brick-and-mortar pharmacies. Wool Adoye, a pharmacist living in Decatur, said he closed his two pharmacies in Decatur and laid off his 15 employees in 2016 because of low dispensing fees in an earlier version of Medicaid managed care. And continuing from the local page, Decatur girl battles rare disorder. There is no cure for Alexander disease, a neurodegenerative disorder. Donette Beckett writes, Stephanie Singh's daughter, Brianna, was 17 months old when she noticed the toddler was having problems walking. She had also begun to have seizures. Singh wanted to know what was going on with her daughter. Doctors were concerned, too. We were lost and didn't know what to do, Singh said. We asked all the questions. No one gave us answers. Brianna's symptoms were common in patients with leukodystrophies, which include regression in developmental skills such as speech and fine motor skills. One of the diseases under the category of leukodystrophies is Alexander disease. The United States National Library of Medicine says more than 500 known cases have been reported worldwide since the disease was first described in 1949. According to Amy Waldman, assistant professor of neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, Alexander disease is a neurodegenerative disorder, or the progressive loss of neurons. There is currently no cure for Alexander disease, but it is important for patients of all ages to see a physician knowledgeable in this rare disease, she said. Some symptoms improve with medications and intensive therapies. Children diagnosed with Alexander disease are typically under 4 and have seizures and developmental delay with a rapid acceleration of the size of the head, Waldman said. Other children and adults present with swallowing dysfunction, voice changes, vomiting, eye movement, and balance problems, she said. Brianna was tested for Alexander disease in 2010. However, her test came back negative. We were ecstatic, her mother said, but I was so frustrated. The family was living in Colorado at the time. Her doctors there were also becoming frustrated. As a single mother, Singh moved the family back to Decatur to be near her family. She has 2 other children, April, 7, and Jordan, 3. The new doctors would eventually test the little girl again. However, since the original tests for Alexander's disease were negative, for years neither Singh or the doctors felt the need to retest. She had been tested for so much, Singh said, and everything was negative. 4 years later, Brianna's condition had worsened. She no longer walked or crawled and was dependent on her mother for everything. She was unable to eat or drink and was given a feeding tube. She dehydrates so quickly with this disease, Singh said. When the doctors administered the blood test for Alexander's disease in October 2016, the family received a different result. Then in June 2017 was the second one that confirmed it with 2 positives, Singh said. The results of the test were delayed and Brianna's condition worsened. Leukodystrophies are often diagnosed after irreversible central and peripheral nervous system injury has occurred, Waldman said. Early recognition of these disorders is imperative to enable potential therapeutic interventions. Singh understands the reality of her daughter's disease. She knows Alexander disease does not have a cure, and many children do not survive past the age of 9. I'm just hoping she can regain some strength and hold on for as long as she can, she said. Today, the 10-year-old has remained at the same stage with a few small steps forward. She is not able to talk, but she can communicate through the special bond with her mother and her grandmother, Roberta Schwanderlich. Singh said Brianna is not progressing, but she's not regressing either. The little girl is able to drink a milkshake from time to time. She is a little bit better, she said, which gives me hope. Singh does what she can to make sure Brianna and the rest of the family is happy. Family and friends have created fundraisers in hopes of making Brianna's life more comfortable. In the past, they have been able to purchase a chair and other equipment. For Brianna's 10th birthday in May, they took a trip to Disney World. Future plans include the purchase of a specialized van. Brianna is often heard singing Hallelujah, a melody her mother is happy to hear. She also says, Happy Birthday, Singh said. She never really sang before. And to learn more about Brianna Singh and Alexander disease, visit prayers-4bri.com. That's prayers-4, www.forbree.com. Next, East Maine violence continues. Man, 34, suffers life-threatening injuries in Sunday morning shooting. This from Decatur. A Decatur street with a history of violence claimed another victim early Sunday when police said a 34-year-old man was shot and suffered life-threatening injuries in the 1000 block of East Main Street. Patrol officers went to the area at 3:10 a.m. Sunday after reports of gunshots, Decatur Police Lieutenant Brian Cleary said in a statement. At about the same time, the victim was taken from there to HSHS St. Mary's Hospital and was later transferred to HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield. A condition update on the victim was not available Sunday night. Police have responded to what Cleary described as numerous calls for service in the area related to shots fired and other serious crimes, he said. On May 24th, two people were shot in the 1100 block of East Main Street, an incident in which two arrests have been made. A check through the Herald and Review archives reveals numerous reports of other shots fired incidents in the area, and the shooting and wounding of a 12-year-old girl in the 800 block of East Main Street in November prompted widespread community concern and a call to rein in gun violence. Janelle Norman, NAACP Decatur Chapter President, said it was time for families in the area to meet with police and start searching for solutions. She proposed having the meeting away from the area, perhaps hosted at a church, so residents won't feel intimidated or fear being branded a snitch. Norman said a police-citizen partnership was the way forward to identify problems and how to tackle them. She said the police can't be expected to fix all of society's troubles on their own, and simply calling for more patrols and stepped-up enforcement activities can spark resentment. I think you need the community to buy into the search for a solution, she said. What are your expectations of the police? What are the expectations that the police would have of you? If we're going to tackle the problem of street violence, we've got to do it together. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland said detectives had worked through the early morning hours and long into the day Sunday, investigating the latest shooting. Police were pursuing leads, but no arrests had been made Sunday night. Anyone with information is asked to call the police department at 217-424-2711, its investigations division at 217-424-2734, or if they would like to remain anonymous, they can call Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477. Next, fire damages Decatur home Sunday evening. Tony Reed writes from Decatur, a fire Sunday evening left a single-story Decatur home badly damaged. Neighbors said they called 911 after spotting smoke curling from the windows and roof of the house at 3870 East Grand Avenue about 7:15 p.m. By 7:30 p.m., firemen had the blaze knocked down, but smoke could still be seen venting from the roof. Stephanie Spellman, who raised the alarm, said firemen had said later that two pet Chihuahua dogs had perished in the blaze, but their owner was not home at the time of the fire. My dad went over there and opened the door and hollered inside, and our mom was yelling through the windows to see if anybody was at home, said Spellman, 24, who lives directly behind the house on East Hickory Street. My dad had said he could see flames in the kitchen. Firemen were still working the scene later Sunday night and could not yet provide more information. And we'll take a break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, June 18th, 2018. Please stay tuned.